Thank you for your generosity and support of the church and its work. So, why am I talking about war and peace on Mother's Day? That's easy, right? Because Julia Ward Howe and the Mother's Day Proclamation. Julia saw the devastation firsthand from the Civil War and around the world in Europe. Just a few years later, another great war began. So she called women, mothers in particular, to arise then. We women of one country will be too tender to those of another country to allow our sons to be trained to injure theirs. Julia Ward Howe's statement, of course, reflects the very strict gender roles of 1870 America, that women should leave their place in the home for this one occasion to convince the folks who decide things, men, to change. But this is the original Mother's Day notion, a day of peace, a day to work for peace in the real world. Mother's Day didn't catch on as a holiday until much later, when it had been transformed into a holiday about flowers and gifts and all that jazz. But there is no reason we can't do both. Do something nice for your mother or for someone who is like a mom to you, but also remember this, the anguish of war and the dream of peace. Okay then, but why am I talking about Iran? Because it is important to be specific. Sometimes we preachers, and I've done it too, we can get a little abstract. We talk about peace in the heart and how peace is an active force in one's life and how to make daily decisions about nonviolence, about forgiveness and understanding and all that. That's all good stuff, but it's very personal. There's a good reason for doing this. One, it's important. It helps folks. And none of you by yourself get to decide whether or not we go to war with Iran. We are not the deciders. So what's the point? Sometimes we clergy think in talking about things that we don't have direct control over. But we should know better. 10 years ago, when a bunch of neoconservative saber rattlers convinced the country to go to war with Iraq, a lot of ministers just stayed quiet. Not David Weisbart, who was your minister at the time. I know no one will ever accuse Dave Weisbart of staying quiet. But some ministers did stay quiet. When folks lied about Iraq's nuclear ambitions, when threats were exaggerated and hyped up, when dissent was silenced, when critics were fired for speaking up, when folks who didn't agree were called unpatriotic, some religious folks talked about peace in the heart and forgot that it is the duty of the prophetic church to read and interpret the signs of the times, to see what's happening and say something. I am deeply concerned that this country will be dragged into a war with Iran. I fear it greatly, and you should too. I think we need to speak out about it. Speak first to our families and friends, neighbors and coworkers, and then we need to write and call our political leaders, make our voice heard. And we need to think carefully about this fall's election and what it means and what it could mean for those of us who wish to see no more young men dead in the streets of faraway lands. No matter the uniform or religion of these young men, for each soldier, each civilian, each one whose life might end was first a child of a mother who birthed and loved and hoped. So maybe you haven't been paying a ton of attention to Iran. There's a lot going on in our own personal lives and in the Rockford region and in our country. The election is almost entirely about domestic issues and mostly the economy, and that's understandable. So let me give you a brief sketch, just so you understand the situation as it stands. Some of you may know all about this, and that's great, but bear with me for the rest of us. The situation is changing all the time. If you want to tell Iran's story, you have to go back many thousands of years. There were many various kingdoms and realms until a great king about 2,600 years ago started taking down these lesser states and created out of them a modern empire. For 300 years, this empire was the world's largest, a modern state with tolerance for diversity, great works projects, and a large bureaucracy to manage the empire. The history since then is a history of invading forces, first Alexander the Great, and then Islamic Arabs and Mongol hordes and Ottoman Turks and British colonialists. Each one, in turn, tries to take over. But eventually, in every case, the strong Persian culture reasserts itself, makes a accommodation if necessary, and returns the land to the people. After the First World War, a young military officer, Reza Pahlavi, took over the country, becoming its Shahnashah, King of Kings. He ruled until the Second World War, when the British felt he was insufficiently supportive of their oil needs. The British needed oil for their war, and so the father was replaced, and the son, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, was installed as the second Shahnashah. At first, the second Pahlavi gave a lot of ground to the elected parliament. But when the Speaker of Parliament tried to nationalize the oil industry in 1951, there was a power struggle, and eventually the Americans and the British organized a coup to put Pahlavi back in power and keep the oil in British and American hands. Before BP was British Petroleum, they were the Anglo-Persian Oil Company. And it was that company, the precursor of BP, that organized an oil boycott in 1952 after the Iranian parliament nationalized the country's oil and thus helped bring about the coup, where the boycott caused dissent in the government. There was no money to fund things. For a while, the British and then the Americans were happy with the arrangement. The second Pahlavi back in power, they got the oil that they wanted. They held a bulwark in the region against the Soviets, and it was just fine from their perspective, our perspective. They looked the other way at Pahlavi's secret police brutalized and tortured the people of Iran. But in 1973, the Iranians joined the oil embargo, and relations strained. It was at this time that the Shah started trying to develop nuclear power for the purpose of energy, as a way to be a modern state, to have prestige and international clout. Just before the Shah was ousted by the Islamic Revolution in 1979, American intelligence worried about his clandestine nuclear program. When students and clergy and others rose up against the Shah and his regime in 1979, relations with the West totally broke off. And we've been worried about their nuclear program ever since. In 1992, Israeli parliamentarian Benjamin Netanyahu told his colleagues in the parliament in Israel that Iran is 3 to 5 years, he said, from being able to produce a nuclear weapon, and that the threat has to be uprooted by an international front headed by the United States. Well, not so much. It's been a lot more than 3 to 5 years. It's been a lot of breathless concern over the decades. But the most recent unbiased analysis suggests that though the Iranians continue to make occasional progress on nuclear technology, they are not putting together a weapon. This is the key issue. And if war talk ramps up, as I worry that it might, this is what you're going to hear about. Some folks, now Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, first among them, followed by all those neoconservative saber rattlers who led us to war in Iraq, these folks say, we have to stop Iran from developing the capacity to build a nuclear weapon. Other folks, like President Obama and a lot of others, say, we have to stop Iran from building a nuclear weapon. The difference between those two camps is the word capacity. Capacity. What a lot of folks think, and I've been doing a lot of reading on this, is that the Iranian government does want the capacity to have a weapon, the pieces in place they could build one if they wanted to, but they won't actually build it unless they feel like they have to, because they know it crosses a line. If they are threatened by those same neoconservative saber rattlers, then they might cross the line. So we all say we want peace, but like the grapes, we aren't using the same words for what peace is. There's another position, of course, deterrence. So what if they develop a nuclear weapon? We have them, and so does Israel and India and Pakistan and Britain and France and China and Russia and North Korea. South Africa and Canada and Japan and Germany and a handful of others have the capacity to make them if they wanted to. I thought that after Iraq, we realized that preventative war was unjust and unwise, that we wouldn't go to war unless we were attacked. We certainly wouldn't go to war on trumped-up, hyperventilating nonsense again. We surely wouldn't be so stupid as to follow the exact same people who led us into war in Iraq into another war next door in Iran. But these fools, these naive warmongers, are at it again. Christopher Preble, who's a foreign policy expert at the Cato Institute, said, "I can't name a single Romney foreign policy advisor who believes the Iraq war was a mistake. Not one. This terrifies me, and it should terrify you too. Do we not remember already?" I know that my brother-in-law, who served a year in Iraq and whose friends died before his eyes, remembers. Thousands of military families remember. The children of Iraq remember. The mothers remember. Here's how we get from where we are to war, the scenario I hope we can stop. A few weeks ago, there was a negotiating session between Iraq and what's called the P5 plus one. You might hear this in the news. What is P5 plus one? It's the five permanent members of the United Nations Security Council, the United States, Britain, France, Russia, and China, plus one. Germany gets to be the plus one on this date. I don't know why exactly, but they're part of it. And they had a negotiating session with the Iranian government, and surprisingly, the session went well. President Obama's ratcheting up sanctions has gotten the Iranian government to be serious, and so folks are hopeful that when they meet again next week, week and a half, the week, the talks will go well. But let's say they don't, which could be the case. They have not always gone well. A few weeks ago, Benjamin Netanyahu, remember now the Prime Minister of Israel, shored up his governing coalition. The main opposition party just up and joined his team. And this puts elections off for another year or year and a half. Some folks think that now that Netanyahu has a stronger hand, he won't need to attack Iran in order to rally domestic support. While other folks think that now that he's silenced critics of an attack, which the other party was, he has a green light to go ahead and do what he wants. Most Israelis strongly oppose an attack on Iran without American support. And Netanyahu probably won't launch an attack without us. But what if it's October and talks have broken down and Romney's neoconservative advisors are yelling about an existential threat to Israel and Obama feels boxed in and the polls are tight and Netanyahu says, "We're bombing whether you're with us or not. But if you're not with us, you'll look weak right before an election. So there. You won't get Florida's electoral votes if you don't back us." Or what if those same neoconservatives wind up in power if John Bolton, dear Lord, is Secretary of State next year? Then you can bet on it. We will have war with Iran. This issue this year is more important to me than almost anything else. This is what I worry about. An attack on Iran by Israel alone or with our help would be an unmitigated disaster. It would take the knees out from the reformers in Iran. There's a presidential election in Iran in 2013. And Ahmadinejad is term limited. They have presidential term limits, and Rouhani can't run again. Maybe the reformers can make some gains, but not if they've been attacked. If you want Iran to go from the capacity to make a nuclear weapon to actually making a nuclear weapon, the best way to do that would be to attack them. It would only accelerate their program. It would also drive oil prices up dramatically, which would give the Iranian regime more money to pacify their people who are restless for change and build up their military. Plus, a lot of people would die. A whole lot of people. Sons and daughters of mothers and fathers. It would be a very bad thing. Our Unitarian Universalist faith at its best calls us to be prophets for peace, to read the signs of the times and speak out against unnecessary and ill-advised wars, to value human life, whether near or far. The Persian people are an ancient people with a rich culture. For 3,000 years, they have repeatedly thrown off dictatorial rule and self-corrected their own mistakes. When left to their own devices, the Persian empires and kingdoms have been a force for understanding and peace and prosperity in the region. But when foreign powers have meddled, as we often have over the last few thousand years, on the other hand, the results have usually been bad for everyone. Our faith calls us also to use our reason, to base our decisions on facts and research and a never-ending search for truth. Don't believe everything you watch on television or read in the paper or hear over the lunchroom table. Do your own investigation. Talk about what you find out. People might speak different languages. They might have different histories. We see things differently. And sometimes we fight over these differences. We even go to war over them. But our faith says, as really all religions at heart say, our faith says that beneath our differences, we are one human family. We all love and hope. We all fear pain and enjoy beauty. We all hunger, and we all love our children. We need folks wise enough to see below difference, folks who can remind us of our common nature, to speak up, to be heard, to call us away from plans for war and call us back to the life of peace. Who shall be these wise voices? I hope it will be a worldwide chorus, diverse and strong voice, and I pray that each of us will join in with our whole being, our strongest voice, and join the eternal song, peace for every land, for every child. It's not too late. These things haven't happened yet. And we can speak up and speak out and change minds and pay attention and make sure we are not caught by surprise. We can follow the wisdom of our faith and the voice of our conscience and build a world of peace, not war. May we do so. Let's sing. It's in your teal hymnal number 1026, If Every Woman in the World, and I invite you to rise in body or in spirit.